basics and human interaction. It's not in a can.
Welcome to Chats from the Mat, yoga-inspired conversations with Brian McRae Davis.
I am speaking with Daniel Scott.
Commence the gem dropping.
This is a conversation with myself, Brian McRae Davis, and Daniel Scott, who is a traveling yoga teacher and acroyoga teacher. Now, we caught up at Wanderlust in Snowshoe Resort in West Virginia. We talk about how he got started, which really began at 27 years old when he left New York to go and travel the world, and in that process discovered yoga. And in doing so, he reinvented himself in a way that he could live honestly and happily, and also get to see some of the fun and amazing places around the world. For a while, it was fun. But then he began to look for a more rewarding experience, and so he transitioned to start to focus on giving students and communities something more than just a physical workout. Daniel gives us his perspective on teaching with authenticity, on teaching by asking questions rather than providing answers, and he explains that one's success is not an indicator of one's ability to teach. There are plenty of successful teachers that are not skillful teachers, and also the opposite is true. When looking at his personal practice, he is constantly asking himself, what am I doing? Where is this going? And how does it feel? The answers to those questions guide his teaching. Now, during our conversation, he also turns the tables and asks me a few questions. I hope you enjoy this Chat from the Mat, yoga-inspired conversations with me, Brian McRae Davis, talking to Daniel Scott.
Daniel, where are we?
We are atop some strange mountain in West Virginia at a yoga festival called Wanderlust Snowshoe.
And we're in day two of the presentation. Been here now for 3 days. How you feeling?
Oh, man. Day two has been good so far. I slept well and went for a walk and had breakfast. And I also got to finally get the lay of the land. It's a pretty big space, even though it's a wide open space. I haven't had a chance to walk around and take it in. So I did that this morning, and it was pretty.
Now, this is not your first rodeo. You've done more than one Wanderlust.
Yeah, I've Wanderlusted a few times. I've actually Wanderlusted around the world. So this is my third presentation at a stateside, quote-unquote, Wanderlust, and maybe my fifth or sixth Wanderlust overall.
Wow. So can you give me the cities or locations?
Sure. I did New Zealand and Taupo twice. I did it. My first Wanderlust was 2 years ago with them, and then I went to Australia for the second Wanderlust that I taught at Cockatoo Island, which is it's kind of like a mix. It's like a haunted island version of Alcatraz.
Really?
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And then I taught at, Squaw Valley, and then I did Oahu, and I did Taupo again this past year, and now I'm here.
I've been to not as many as you have, but I have been to a few, and they do choose their locations very well.
Yeah, well, you know, I've always called these yoga spring break.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of, like, the classes are great, and it's, you know, festivals and conferences in general are great, right, resources for people who don't have access to so many great teachers at once that you can kind of get, like, a little buffet. You try a little bit of this, a little bit of that. But it's really nice that it's not just in like an ugly old convention center somewhere in, you know, Skokie, Illinois or something like that. They make it a full on assault of a sensual assault, so to speak. So, sure. And I appreciate the, like, and then also there's that, and then there's the music and culture aspect, which is also really nice.
Now, is your primary occupation a traveling teacher then?
Yes, I did it. Woo! No, it took a long time. I mean, I haven't always been a yoga teacher. Up until I was 27, I worked in advertising and marketing. And then I had one of those, the beginning of, well, probably the biggest existential crisis that one could have at 27 was, my girlfriend broke up with me.
Yeah.
And I didn't want that. And I wasn't ready for it. And I had to pretty much either decide if I'm going to continue doing the same things I was doing at the time, which was be living in New York and being, you know, a young executive just trying to make money and some sort of difference
to something or actually figure out what I wanted to do. And I just had this opportunity to leave New York and start traveling. I went to India with a couple friends who just finished acroyoga teacher training, and that's how I kind of got into acroyoga. And then when they left, I kept going, and it just turns out that if people invite you to go somewhere, they usually mean it. And I kept a list of emails and phone numbers, and then long story short, after doing what I would equate to being like a small band touring around the world, just trying to take every gig, I made a name for myself and for what I do, and then it's become now the main job. So,
what you just described was all of that, the follow up to the existential questioning of self and breakup that, or was there more time that you just compressed?
Oh no, there was yes, there was a bit more to it than just, you know, girlfriend breaks up with me, become a traveling international yoga teacher, and then, you know, life wins. No, it was, there was a lot going on. I think, you know, it's so easy to talk about, like, the story of, like, oh, well, then this happened, and then this happened, and then I did this, and this was very, very important, and then that happened, and then this was... So there's story and there's truth. And the truth really came down to the fact that I wasn't happy with what I was doing, and I didn't know why. I thought I was sort of happy, but it really turned out I wasn't. And even all the things that I was doing were addressing symptoms and not the actual cause. And the symptoms, you know, I'm not happy, I'll go out tonight and have a party, or I'm not happy, I'll make some more money, or I'll do better at my work, or I'll find a better apartment, or maybe I'll go get a better girlfriend, someone that would work with me better, blah blah blah. And it was always like the external, like, oh, I have this not working, I'll just change this, I'll change this. But I never really looked inward and was like, well, why wasn't I happy at my work? Why wasn't I happy with my, like, why weren't my partners happy with me? Why wasn't I not, like, super satisfied? Mm-hmm. And it's because I wasn't really listening to what I wanted. And does that mean I'm better now? I just happen to be a traveling yoga teacher who is doing pretty well for himself with a name and serving a community. But I feel like what I've been able to change is, over the course of the 10 years that I've been doing this, my honesty with, instead of looking outward to the problems, I look inward to where the cause might be coming from. And then that, feedback loop is a lot shorter. Mm-hmm. And yoga has helped a lot. I think yoga and meditation and just being in a conscious community, quote unquote, where people aren't afraid to have conversations like this, or you don't have to be afraid to have conversations like this because people won't look at you like, the fuck are you talking about, man? You know?
Yeah.
So and to be able to then bring all of the exploration and experience that I've had within this yogic expansion, and then also still remember and be on and honor the experience and roots of, like, you know, the 10 or 15 years I put in the monastery of the working world as a professional monk, quote unquote, an austere monk who was just, you know, fully dedicated to enlightenment through dollar signs and material things, and realize that there's not bad or good. It's just sort of what works and what doesn't.
Yeah.
And what's working right now is being honestly committed to figuring out, like, the truth, and not so much fluffing up the story anymore.
Okay. One thing that I find very fascinating is when people that start in the corporate world and then make a transition as a yoga teacher or some other facet of the yoga business, how that transition happens.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you go from working in New York City in the corporate world to becoming a traveling, and not so much the internal mm-hmm. shift, but how are you able to make a living at it?
Interesting. I mean, you know, we could, like, it's could be like almost construed as a numbers game in that, I had X amount of dollars in my account, which wasn't that much. You know, I could have bought a new car in cash. I could have bought a newish car in cash. Decent, low mileage. When I decided to get on the road and, you know, just take some time for myself, you know. And I said, okay, when I get to, you know, 0.5 times X, I will stop and go back to New York and I will get a job and I'll just, like, I'll go have fun for, you know, this amount of money. Whatever long time it is,
I'm just going to do it.
So it wasn't a time frame. It was a dollar.
I actually quit my job and I like got rid of all my things and just like I moved out of my apartment. I'm like, you know, I can always start over. It's easy to start over. Like at least at the time it was very easy to start over in New York. Like getting jobs are easy. You know, like that's never been a problem. It's more just like, I got to figure out what I really want, or at least take some time to just, you know, let the swelling go down and figure out what I can do. So I went from, you know, so I was at X and then I was like, okay, I'll give myself 0.5 times X, you know, half of X to get, you know, once that's done, like once I dip below that, I got to go back and keep it at that level. Cause for whatever reason, that was the number that I thought was important.
Okay.
And, yeah, so, you know, like the first part of the travels were, you know, not too expensive. I went to India and went to like Southeast Asia. I was just buying like plane tickets and then just keeping things kind of close to the, you know, not expensive. And then I was taking a yoga class somewhere in Goa and I just loved the teacher so much. I was like, wow, this is amazing. I think I really want to study with her. I think I'm going to become a yoga teacher. This sounds like a great, it's like, that's a couple months. Okay. It's like $2,500. Great. It's an 8-week intensive course. Sure. I have the time. Yeah, and then what was funny was during that time, I, in addition to studying yoga, I was teaching acro, even though I wasn't an acro yoga teacher yet. But like, whatever. You know, people wanted to know. I happened to know some things. And I just started teaching. And they're like, oh, well, you should come here. Great. Well, I'll just call you. And after training, yoga training, and then I did acro training, and then the first thing I did is I flew from... Where was it? Somewhere in Greece, like the island of Lesbos. No, was it? Yeah, it was. I think it was Lesbos. I don't remember. Wherever the teacher training was, flew right to Vienna, and I taught a 4-day immersion, and I made all the money back in that time. And I was like, oh, I didn't take into account that I could actually put more money back in towards X. And like, woo, this is interesting. Well, let's go to other places and add more to X. And then like, I just got to this point where I wasn't putting money in, I wasn't taking money out, I was just kind of like living. Mm-hmm. And at the time, because I had no real connection to a place or a thing, I didn't have a mortgage, I didn't have kids, I didn't have a dog or an animal, all this stuff was in storage. Why not just go see what I can do and like really focus on just kind of building and connecting and exploring? I love traveling. I love doing these things. And so that went on for a few years. And then it got a little tired. I started realizing I was getting a little rough around the edges. My hair was getting a bit too long. My clothing was getting a bit too tattered. And while I wasn't like, leveling up or leveling down, I felt like there was a certain part that I was plateauing even in this like place of expansion. And I decided to ground down and I ended up in Miami for 6 months. Then I took a job in Turks and Caicos for about a year. And I just started and was like, back to business. I was a spa director at a very high-end spa at a luxury hotel for a while. And then I went from there, I moved to San Francisco and I helped start a chocolate company. And all the time taking, like, you know, while I was still getting invitations to go teach places, I wasn't doing it as much. It was really about focusing and grounding down and building a community in one place and realizing that once I was able to, I started making a foundation and having another job, but it was still a job that I could teach regularly. Mm-hmm. And I got to this point where I wasn't teaching to feed myself. I was just teaching because it was more nourishing to teach. And I was helping other people become nourished. So I at one point had something like 18 classes a week, half acro, half yoga, and pretty much a full-time job when I was living in the Bay. And it was wonderful because it was just like everything I was doing on the road, but I didn't have to go anywhere.
Now that's a pretty heavy teaching.
Oh yeah. They were hour long classes. I do back to back to back, like three at a time for two guys, like two twice a week. And then I had a couple over here and a couple over there but everything was within biking distance. It was great.
And on top of a regular job.
Yeah. Well, it was a regular job where, you know, the office hours were whatever I wanted. And I was the CMO. So it's like, I could do it from home. I could do it from the office. I can do it on the road. It was easy.
Okay.
Easy, quote unquote. When you like what you do, it's easy. Yeah. And then, the chocolate thing wasn't really, it just turned out wasn't my project. It was someone else that I was helping. And like, it occurred to me like, wow, if this thing gets sold or falls apart, I'm not making anything out of it. And like, to be honest, as much as I really loved it, I wanted something for myself. And I realized I kept getting all these invitations and I was not living up to something that got me where I was, which was this idea that if someone makes the effort to give you a really good invitation, you should make the effort to accept it. And that's how a lot of my jobs, like my gigs in the beginning happened, was just, oh, you like what I do? Cool. Oh, you want me to come? Sure. And so I got a couple invitations to go teach at some festivals in Europe. And crazy thing about European yoga festivals is that they'll pay for you to go there. They'll fly you there and they'll put you up. Wild. Unlike anywhere else in the world. So, then it just was like, well, I'm in Europe for here. If I'm going to be in Germany, well, you know, Austria's not too far away. London's not too far away. Like, I can just kind of travel and teach again. So then I would do, like, kind of laps 2 to 3 times a year. I'd go back and forth between here and Europe. And then Asia from time to time, like once a year, twice a year. And it just kind of, I was like, well, I'll just do it for a year. And then I'll go back to figuring out what I'm going to do. I'm just going to do it for a year. And I'll just keep going back to what I do. And therein lied the existential crisis again, is that like, I liked what I was doing, but was I in love with what I was doing, or was I really owning what I was doing? I originally put yoga teacher on my resume because I did not want to have a lapse in professional, additions to my actual resume, sure, my CV. Just growing up the way I grew up, just like, there's always like, you don't want to look like you're doing nothing, because then you're doing nothing and your potential employers won't hire you. Like, oh, do you just been sitting around doing nothing? Okay. Yeah. Not ours. So I put on like, you know, I was like, I'm a yoga teacher, an event organizer around the world. I would lead community conferences and festivals and retreats and da, da, da. It turned out, it kind of bumped up against something I say a lot to myself and then also to people who want to train to become teachers or anything like that, is that you got to fake it till you make it. You know, like, you don't know what you're going to teach. Just go and pretend you do. And if you, and you'll get feedback. If it worked, you'll get feedback. If it doesn't, and then you learn, and then you keep faking it until you make it. But the addendum to that is, once you make it, you need to stop faking it. And I think only recently in the past year, I've accepted the fact, I've not even begrudgingly, like, I'm owning, like, I made it. Like, I am a teacher who travels, and I can support myself, and I can connect, and I have something to offer, but I no longer can be in that mode of faking it, which is looking for something else. Like, I have to fully step into the fact that if I'm doing this, I'm doing this. And even if it's for 6 months, like, I don't look to like what the next project is. It's just like, I'm a teacher. I'm creating this event. I'm creating this experience. I'm creating something to contribute to a community larger than what I have around me. And that's been a big shift now. That, so that existential crisis that started when I was 27, almost 10 years ago. And like now, as I enter in my 37th year in a few days, I feel like it's not about the fake make relationship. It's like now that you've made it, how do you like continue to nurture it? Whatever it is. And that's kind of exciting to me. Hmm. So it's just a short decade, Brian. Not a big deal. Just travel around the world, add a bunch of stamps to the passport, got a lot of mileage in my mileage. Like, you know, I'm a platinum member in Star Alliance as a result. It worked out very well for me. But, yeah, now it's like, well, what do I do with all this stuff? That's the exciting part. Like, how do I cultivate? How do I nurture? And then how do I let it, how do I allow myself to be not the guy who's just waiting for the next job, but like to be the teacher or the instructor or the mentor to whoever wants to like have the experience that I've had, whoever's going to experience the experience. How can I create that experience so they can learn from it? Not my take on it, but their own take from it.
Okay. My takeaway from what you've just described is that when you are starting out, the philosophy seemed to be, if you get an invitation to do something interesting or go someplace cool, do what you can to accept that invitation. Mm-hmm. Now it sounds like, okay, this is my life. This is my living. I'm going to keep doing that, but there's a different focus on it.
Well, it's interesting you put it that way. I think what just came up for me with that is, you know, in the beginning, always accept invitations, but there's got to be a point where if you're constantly accepting invitations, like, what are you giving? I mean, like, I'm sure I'm showing up and I'm creating an experience. But I think I'm at a point now where I get to extend invitations. Huh. That I feel that there is value to the things that I've done, at no matter what the cost was. Like, the value I place a great value on what I do. Mm-hmm. Because I have to, because if I didn't, I'd be a fraud. Like, I'd just be lying to everyone I met, like, that. So now I get to extend invitations to people, to whomever. I get to, basically now I get to stick my neck out and be like, okay, I'm doing this retreat. or I'm having a teacher training or an educator training, or I'm creating this experience. Do you want to come and enjoy it? And then I have to stand by the things that I'm like, that I embody. That I, like, if I, a lot of people know me because I create videos, or a lot of people know me because I teach online. And a lot of times I meet people that I've connected with digitally or virtually, and then I meet them in person. And my biggest hope is that the promise is kept, that people, when they meet me in person, they're like, oh, you're exactly what I expected. Not like, oh, what a surprise. Like, I would like them on one hand to be like, you're exactly what I expected, and I'm surprised with how much more you have to offer. It would be really nice. But
yeah.
I believe in authenticity through the owning of one's shit, so to speak. And I think that is, I'm much more mindful of that now as I enter into this next phase, or I guess if we're going to call this a phase, the next phase of my career, which is, you've done the work, but now you continue doing the work, but then how do you help others, or how can your work connect others to something greater? It's not about me anymore. It's about, like, what's the purpose? How can I get in my own way so what I'm trying to share is actually shines brighter?
Okay, so I guess maybe another way to think, since you've explained a little more, another way of looking at this career transition is, in the beginning, you always had this basement, this threshold, where if your bank account ever got below a certain point, you changed things. And so as long as you didn't hit that point, you're fine, you're good. And then there was a middle phase where not only were you trying to maintain, you know, financial comfort or liquidity, you were also putting some of your own finances into some of the projects to bring people out, where you were saying, not only am I just going to show up, but I'm going to make these retreats or something that's going to require.
You take a chance.
Yeah. And now you're taking it a step further, where you're going to keep doing that, but you want to bring people and not just have a good experience, but have them leave with something more, whether it might be a teacher training, evolution in personality. Or
yeah, experience. I mean, that's a very, very astute, I guess, summation. I think there's this, as a yoga teacher, you're sort of, and I hate to even use the term as a yoga teacher, because I mean, what's yoga? What's teaching? You know, I can go into semantics, but as someone who shares a practice of movement, whatever that movement is, are the things that you're sharing really making a difference? You know, yes, people might feel better. Yes, people might actually solve their problems or create, you know, like they might, you know, move away from suffering towards sort of like abundance or whatever that is. Like, you know, do they feel better in their bodies? Do they feel better in their minds? Do they feel better in their practice? Do they feel better about their lives by taking a class? You know, it's a hard thing to track, to measure, and even to a certain degree to own. You know, like, I take great ownership over the things that I'm sharing. And at the same time, there's this idea of cost and value that, as the guy who's the type A personality from New York, when I would go to a class and I didn't get what I wanted, I knew what I wanted was to do this, this, or this, and it didn't happen, or I didn't like the way the teacher said this, and I didn't like the way the studio smelled, or I didn't like the way, like, that, you know, that they showed up. Maybe I didn't believe them, because there's something that I would always, when a lot of times when a teacher teaches that I go to, and then if I don't like a class, it's a lot because I don't think that teacher's actually there. I think they're just reading from a script on the back of their eyelids, and they're doing what they think they need to do. Mm-hmm. And because I've been guilty of that myself for 10 years, for like a long time, you know, for half my life, you know, just I did what I thought I needed to do to get what I wanted. And there is this shift of, like, going from what I did, what I thought I needed to do, to I did just what I needed to do, and then I got what I needed. And this idea of, if someone's going to spend money or time to commit to working with me, I want the value to exceed the cost. If they're paying $20 or $50 or $100 or $1,000, I want them to not just enjoy the fact that they've gone on a holiday or they've come to a class. I don't want to live in someone's happy place. I want that person to take the things that they've learned or they've experienced in the happy place and then bring it back to where they go and make the happy place like the happy life. And again, because now I'm not teaching regular classes constantly or consistently, but when I did, the time that I would spend with students who came to regular classes was just enough to, like, let steam off, because I had to do that when I was, you know, in a regular day-to-day life. You take classes, you let steam off. Like, allows you to the demons stop talking so loudly. Like, oh, I practiced yoga. I feel better. I can go have dinner, watch a movie, go to bed. I did my thing. But when you do long weekends or you do conferences or festivals or you do retreats, people pay a good amount of money and time to commit to you. And at that point, how can you be there fully for them in some sort of experience? And at the same time, give them tools to take back with them. So it's not about me being a good teacher. It's about them being a better student. Mm-hmm. It's about them having a different experience of, it's not what they expected. It's maybe what I think they need. And then you take a gamble. It's like, well, if I'm not just teaching what I've been told to teach, but I'm teaching what my experience of my teachings have been, I have to take ownership of it's my experience. And that if someone doesn't have that same experience, they have a different experience. At least they're coming from it. Like, you know, this worked for me. And I hope it works for you. And if something comes up that's different, like, I want to be able to know that. And I want to learn from the student as much as the student might learn from me. So that becomes this idea of, I get a little leery about the term, like, teacher, because there's something about it that seems inherently flawed, because most people I know who are teachers just, they hide behind it. I wouldn't say they hide most, but there's the idea of, like, I'm a teacher, I know better. Or there's a teacher, you know, as a teacher, I know better. Or even as a student, that's the teacher, they know better. So whatever they say is canon.
They become the role.
Right. And I mean, as much as I want to take responsibilities for someone's experience of their own practice, like, I can't, I don't know what their body experience is. I don't know what their life experience is. But if I have them for a short period of time, how can I equip them with the one thing that served my practice, both as a movement practitioner, as a teacher, as a human, is to change the shift of awareness from how it looks outwardly to how it feels inwardly. Mm-hmm. And to listen and to give people permission to be their own teacher and to take whatever knowledge I'm giving them as simply an exercise to strengthen their ability to teach themselves from what they're learning, as opposed to being like, this is the teacher, he's telling me this. So if I do this and I don't feel this experience, maybe I'm wrong, you know? But like, well, when I do what he's saying, and this is coming up, well, now this is just coming up. This is feedback. Now it's going to inform my next movement. It's going to inform my next movement. And, you know, on surface levels, like in places like Wanderlust, it's amazing. People come for acro yoga, and a lot of times, you know, like when I try to get when I get their attention, I try to give them something that is both what they expected to be acro yoga, but at the same time, like, how can, I love teaching in questions. Like, what does it feel like if you do this? And what does it look like? Or what's coming up? You know, how can you get your foot from here to here? How can you stay connected to your partner this way? They're open-ended questions because the answer is going to be different for each person. When we do more of an intense weekend or workshop or like week, those questions, you ask open-ended questions, and then you can give people abilities to sift through the answers. Whereas instead of just asking a question and being a fun game, then you can go a little bit deeper. Then you can go a bit like, okay, once that person's answered their question, then you ask the question about the next answer. And so there becomes this sort of if-then statement. Like, if you feel this, then that. If it feels this, then that. And so class or each experience becomes a choose your own adventure that as a facilitator, the person in front, I can help people understand their experiences more clearly or more informed and then help them create their path to where they want to go.
Now, do you, here at Wanderlust, we're teaching in hour and a half containers.
Mm-hmm.
I would assume that you also teach in some of your events in larger containers. Do you have a preference, small to large?
It depends. It really depends on what the event is, right? Like, you know, I've taught classes of over 100 people, and then you get a very broad stroke in a very short period of time to have everyone feel something. It's fun. I actually think it's more marketing than anything else.
Okay.
small events. We'll say, like, you know, my favorite size would be maybe like 30 people for a 15-hour weekend, you know, and, you know, having a partner to teach with, having workshopping, like, you know, we show something, everyone breaks out, tries things and comes back in. What'd you learn? You know, you kind of grow the experience from there. I love that because you can strike a nice balance of taking ownership for that container, creating a direction and creating an attention and then sharing your experience. And then people try their experiences and then they share their experiences. And okay, from the experience of the room, not even of the individual, but of the room, where do we go next? Like that, it's for me, it becomes a choose your own adventure. And as a result, embodying that, studying before the test, but then forgetting everything you studied and just letting it come from inside, that the idea of improv to flesh out the intelligence a person has, the awareness a person has, that it becomes a real fun dance. Smaller groups, like if you get a, you know, a 10-person group for like a good, like four or 5 hour session, like you can go really deep. But then if they're all there for the same thing, it's great. But if they're all there for different things, then it becomes like, how do you not manage expectations, but how do you find that baseline where everyone can meet and learn something and you don't bore the people who are really advanced and you don't like completely bowl over the people who are just showing up? I guess what I'm actually like kind of working out as I say all these things is I love every experience to connect. It's just they're all incredibly different. Sure. And I think that's probably why I do what I do, because I never got excited to go to a desk job and make phone calls. I never got excited to like crush those spreadsheets, man. I did get excited when I got to create a unique experience for people. I did a lot of event production and project management prior to becoming a yoga teacher. That was like, you know, okay, so I have an evening event, and so the user or the attendees are going to show up, and when they show up, this happens, and they see this, and they go up the elevator, and then this happens, and there's this event, and there's this experience, and this experience. I love my main focus with that was this idea of creating a unique experience that someone felt that there was a destination they were going to, and when they arrived, there was this discovery they weren't ready for, but it was like so great. Mm-hmm. And when you discover something, then you bring it back. It's like, oh, I made this discovery. Like the next time something happens, I want to bring two friends. And I want those people to bring two friends. And I want those people to bring two friends. And, you know, enter Acro Yoga, which has become this sort of like physical experience where you can create a beautiful connection with someone you've never met. And then you can give them an experience so that maybe they can go take it to someone else. And then they can take it to someone else. And in the beginning of Acro Yoga, quote unquote, it was like that. And then something happened called like standing hand to hand, which in my opinion has been amazing on one level and terrible on others, because now everyone is so focused on how like their perfect lines look and how amazing the background is and the beautiful tights that they wear and like all the sponsorship and all the likes and all the hashtags and all the this and all the that both yoga and Acro Yoga and movement in general has become super flashy. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to connect with the substance of it.
So all this extraneous, the bells and whistles, the glitter, yeah, is sort of obscuring the joy or the personal transformation or the personal connection, mm-hmm, or whatever it might be that's happening.
Yeah, you know, people, it's become more of a common conversation in general that there's this discussion or this idea that by having more followers that you become a better teacher, or by having a really good practice you are obviously a very good teacher. And there's been this, the destination discovery goes in both ways. Like, okay, I'm going to go to this person's class, they're traveling through my town and they have 500,000 followers, I'll spend $75 for 3 hours, and then they'll go and they'll be like, wow, that was a terrible class, because that person just got thrust into the limelight of being a yoga inspirator, but maybe not a teacher. Mm-hmm. And so then people connect. Well, if they have a lot of likes on each picture and they have a lot of followers, that they obviously must be very good. Or they can do these amazing things. Just because you can do an amazing thing doesn't mean you can actually talk about the amazing thing or create layered progressions to get people there, or even understand that not everyone can do these things. So how do you, when you're an alien, how do you learn to speak human? You know, like if you've been spending all your time just in the stars and your feet are off the ground, like how do you remain connected to where you came from?
A Hall of Fame basketball player is not necessarily going to become a Hall of Fame coach.
How many are there? You know, like, would LeBron James be a great basketball coach? Maybe, but it's not his focus right now. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of times I think the Hall of Fame players, when they become coaches, it doesn't just happen right away. It takes time. And I'm not saying I'm Hall of Fame anything, but the one thing that really has worked, and one of the reasons why I think I can be one of the teachers, I know I'm in a very small percentage of people who can keep traveling and teaching and living off of it, is that I cut my teeth before social media. And I have a following online and it's great and I love it and it's a whole different project, but like I'm not using that to fill classes. I'm using word of mouth and past experiences and, dare I say, a reputation that you might learn something, because I'm constantly learning and I'm constantly trying to expand my growth and ability to share it. And I also taught a lot. I've taught great deals. I've got a lot of experience. I've taken yoga teacher trainings. Doesn't mean I'm a yoga teacher, but I've done multiple trainings and I've assisted on trainings and I've shared trainings and I've done regular classes for years. And I think that now it's hard. The people who are out there teaching, you don't hear from them because they're out there teaching and they're out there having full classes. A lot of times you hear people like, oh, can't wait. My workshop's going to be so good. So excited to share this amazing experience. Like, sign up now. There's only a few early bird spaces left up until like 3 days before the event. You know, and a lot of I see it and I think, oh, this is marketing. It's all marketing. And, you know, I'm equally overjoyed when I show up and a class is full. And I'm equally overjoyed when I show up and a class isn't super full, but there are people who want to be there. And that, again, it doesn't make a difference how many people are in the room. It's just like, how can I give them the experience that matches the cost of what they did to show up? And that I don't just ever check out, but I'm always checking in. Mm-hmm. I don't know if other teachers think about that. Like, I want to say they do. And a lot of times, like, I think it's really important not to, like, I'm not... It's really easy. It would actually be really easy for me to be like poo-poo, like blah, like, you know, everyone has all these followers. I'm certainly overjoyed that whenever someone shows up, I'm honored that they want to spend time with me. And so my commitment to them is to make it worth their time.
And when you take some of these classes with the very popular teachers, you get the impression that they've found, they're using the script or they're using the formula that they believe is going to work. And that every time they step in front of a group of 30 or 70 or whatever it might be, they're pulling that same script or that same formula out again. And they're not really getting anything.
Sure.
They're not looking at the room and saying, oh, I see, we need to shift it because of what I'm viewing in the
room. Right. Yeah. I think if a lot of people from a yoga perspective, you know, when you take a class and you feel like every word the teacher says is speaking to you, even if you don't see the teacher, or you feel like every time they give an adjustment to someone else, like you hear it and you're like, my God, I want to try that. Whoa, it works. Yeah. That's awesome. Like if you can teach without showing your practice, without practicing next to you, but you can teach with your words, that I'm constantly striving for that. But if you're the kind of teacher, this is not a teaching point. And then you do this. And then you do that. I'm sure you get it, man. Whether it's yoga, like I remember taking a class blindfolded a few years ago at one of these Wanderlusts, and it was a co-taught class between one major teacher and another major teacher. And the first major teacher is like, woo, airy fairy. And the other one is super grounded. And the first half of the class, which was blindfolded during the airy fairy step, you know, you just come into Warrior One and then do this and then do this. And then you do this and you connect from the this to the that. And I'm like, and I'm sitting there like blindfolded going, what are you even talking about? You know, I'm blindfolded. There's 150 people. There's 200 people in this class. I'm the only one blindfolded. The only one who's standing there waiting for you to give me a cue. I know it. And they never did. So I just went, I'm just going to stay in this position until I hear something. And then like, you know, I felt like I was standing there for 10 minutes, you know, and then I get like, I find like, step, blah, 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 step into downward facing dog. And I was like, I'm done. Fuck this class. And then the next teacher goes, oh, now you're in downward facing dog. Now step, like, you know, grounding down through the front hands, like you draw your right thigh into your chest and gently place the right foot forward and let's meet in a low lunge. And I was like, oh my God, instruction. And then like, now as you internally rotate this and you expand through that, I was like, oh my God, I can learn by not looking, but by experiencing. Huge thing. Yeah. Being able, like, actions speak very loudly. And oftentimes they speak louder, but a lot of times those actions as a student have to be, they come from somewhere. And if you're in a class and you're watching, you can't do what the teacher's doing because you're not feeling the same thing there about it. Like you're just watching. You're just, oh, you look at your practice. It's amazing. But when someone can say something that inspires an action that can speak loud, it's not about the loudness of the action. It's about the depth of the thing that inspired the action. And that's where the power of the word becomes way more profound.
Okay.
And if you're just a new teacher or if you're just a new practitioner who's been thrust into the limelight and you have a really great strength practice and you have a really great this practice, it's not a question that you're not a good teacher yet or you're not a good teacher. It's just maybe you haven't been given the opportunity to really move people with your words because you're constantly just moving people with your movements. And that's great. And that's just funny, speaking out loud. Like I want to be able, I constantly strive to be able to find ways to take the "and then you do this" out and say, by, you know, starting from here and ending up there, how can you do this to get that? How can you create this to make this shape? And then as you do this, what's coming up? Is it working? Is it not working? What am I doing? Where is this going? How does it feel? Three questions I ask myself constantly as a student when I'm doing anything, as a teacher, as I'm trying to create an experience, as a facilitator, like, what am I listening for? What are they doing? Where are they going? How does this feel? If I can answer these three basic questions, I kind of get that you are here dot becomes super like laser pointed, as opposed to, oh, I'm in snowshoe. Now I'm like, oh, I'm in this room next to this person who's got this thing that I can do, and I can be very mindful of how to help their experience, or at least observe their experience and give them some sort of educated guess on what to do next. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So.
Now you have a special long format, experience that you provide.
Yeah, I do. Are you familiar with Frank Zappa?
I am.
Yeah. You know, he did, like, in his career, I think he made over like 80 albums. Mm-hmm. And I love him so much. He has these like recurring characters and these recurring arpeggios from one album to another, these recurring themes that like you might not hear it. You might not get it until like 3 years later when another album comes out and you're like, oh man, like it came back. There's that kind of like that story, or even watching some movie like The Usual Suspects. Like you don't get it until the end when it all is like,
yeah. Pow!
Long format's a great way of looking at it, Brian. I think that when I do like a one-off class, co-teaching is just like, it's supposed to be, it's fun. That's all you can hope for is fun, unless you have a dedicated co-teaching partnership, because ultimately it's like, you have to find this balance between how does my partner feel? How do I feel? If everything's on like the positive, great. But there are oftentimes when you co-teach, there's this like, oh, well, they said this. Now I have to say that. If it doesn't get said, blah, 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 like whatever. So a lot of times in trying to create a co-teaching experience, it just takes time. But when I'm teaching by myself or I'm teaching in a dedicated co-teaching partnership, long format's a great way of looking at it, because people want to show up and like, you know, within the first hour, they want to me to flip a switch so they can become a better practitioner on some level. And it just takes time to like to say, okay, you want to get there. Yeah, we can start off there, or maybe we can dial it back and I can show you how to get there. And maybe in that experience of you learning how to get there in what I consider to be the safest or most strong or perhaps the right way, quote unquote, you might learn that how you originally thought you're getting there is completely different, or that how you originally got there, you skipped over a huge part. It's like jumping into a handstand versus learning how to climb into a handstand or create a handstand from the ground up, as opposed to jumping up and hoping to find balance, as opposed to, okay, well, now we're going to work on tuck jumps, and we're going to work on headstands or tripod headstand. We're going to work on simply like, you know, finding a forward fold and getting comfortable in inversion, and then like climb up against the wall, and then eventually not using a wall to find balance, but then finding balance in the center of the room. Like you can teach a handstand by saying, put your hands down, kick your feet up and hope for the best. Or you can say, okay, well, let's spend, you know, 3 hours just working on everything but handstand. And then maybe at the end of the class, you have the rest of your life to do handstands. But if you leave the class knowing that these are the tools, if you practice them every day, eventually you'll get to a handstand that's not just like a one time you took a picture. But it's not like it's something you can hold and take a video of.
So you're not using luck to as part of your process.
I'm not relying on my innate skills and abilities as a practitioner to fill in the gaps of someone else's desire to mirror a practice point that I might have.
Okay.
And so from an Acro Yoga standpoint, yeah, I'm the washing machine repairman, or I'm Daniel Scott Yoga, and I've created all these things. It's cool. I love it. I have a great time. But every video, I always leave one little thing out because I want people to like not fully, like unless they have to really pay attention to figure out like, oh, this key point, if I knew that, I could do it. You know, I like, and so when I maybe show up and I'm like, oh, did you try it this way? And they go, oh, but that wasn't in the video. I go, I know, trying to teach yourself from a video online is stupid. You should maybe really enjoy real like human interaction. But then I come, people will come to classes and they'll want me to go like right into the crazy stuff, but then we'll spend 10 hours just going over how to do side star or regular star from a whole different foundational perspective. And then it blows their minds. Cause like, I didn't know I was supposed to get my elbow straight. I didn't know I could bend my knees. I didn't know I was allowed to break the line. honey, you can do whatever you want as long as it works, right? That's how we all made this up. And don't forget, everyone who's teaching you something did the same thing you did, which is they stopped being a student and they just decided at one point they're going to teach, which means they had to come from personal experience of learning. They had to explore. They had to figure it all out. And then they had to find the right ways to share it. And so just kind of running around with this little wand where you kind of like boop people on the head and say, I give you permission to do whatever you want. How does that feel? It's scary and it's cool.
What is the yoga of trust?
Good question. It's a constantly moving idea that, let's look at the words. Like I'm going to take a little bit roundabout. We'll talk about long form on this one. Yoga is to me, a noun and a verb. There is the like movement practice or the spiritual practice that is yoga. That when I say the word yoga, you think, okay, I think sun salutation, or I think pranayama, or I think this, or I think that. So there's that school of movement or school of thought or school of being. There's also a verb of it. You know, it's kind of like the art of this, like the art of music, or the art of improv, or the art of this. Like, you know, when you, there's this idea that if you want to look at yoga as a movement or of energy of something, that it becomes a very fluid idea. Trust is a very similar thing. There's the idea of trust, something that you earn. It's the belief in something that you don't see or you don't understand. You just have to hope that everything's good, that you believe that something's going to hold you up. But there's also this idea that I trust something. And so if you can find that sort of the art of believing in something that you cannot understand through your own practice on a single way, like a singular version, the yoga of trust becomes trusting oneself in order to trust the world around them, trust their own practice, trust themselves to listen to themselves through their own practice so they can create a better connection to it. So when we're talking about the yoga of trust, it's just a system through which people can be honest with themselves through movement, through breath, through conversation or community. Also, the idea of acro yoga, the word to me, used to mean one thing, but it's kind of different now. Like a lot of times people think acro yoga, and again, it goes back to hand to hand or like these crazy flip, like Icarian pops and all this stuff. And that's maybe how it is now. But when it first started, it was like folded leaf and therapeutics. And it was circles and partner yoga flows and like, you know, for the lack of a better term, hippies and parks just having a nice time. But that doesn't make any money. It's really the flash that people want to come for. Mm-hmm. But if you can trick them with flash and like lure them in with flash and then give them substance, that's where I couldn't in good faith teach acro yoga as it was, knowing that if I don't send people off in at least a way that they can experience what brought me to this practice in the first, which was really the ability to like to hold and be held in a very safe, platonic, intimate but not sexual way, to like trust in my own body, to be able to help other people's trust in my body and their body, that there was like the term just became like acro yoga just became super, I don't know, it just wasn't connecting with it anymore. So this idea of calling partner yoga or even yoga movement where you have to believe in yourself so others will believe in you, that's where the yoga of trust came from.
So is it a personal practice, a group community practice, partner practice?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it is. So the trainings that I've done as a teacher training, I've done two yoga of trust teacher trainings, and a lot of it's a blend of personal movements or personal practices and group practices, both from a physical and theoretical point of view. Community development, personal leadership, partner movement, regular movement. The idea that if you really wish to be a teacher, well, what is a teacher? You know, I think being a teacher is a part of the equation. I think really the idea is to be an educator, the idea of leading someone to knowledge so that they can do with that knowledge what they please. That is one who educates. Like they share an experience and they can create an experience, but I can't like give you my experience. I can just give you my access to my experience and hope that you've learned something from it. And so the student comes looking for knowledge. The teacher is the person who's bringing knowledge or creating knowledge. But then to bring that other term that I used in earlier, the facilitator is the person who's listening for knowledge. you know, as the person who's in the room, just trying to make the connections and hear what's coming up for the student and the teacher. And if you can balance all three things, I think you're an educator. And as a result, like a teacher, if you're just coming in to teach, that means I'm in front of the class. Those are the students. There's not a wall, but there's a separation of church and state, so to speak.
Sure.
That, you know, as a teacher, I have to give. And it's like I can receive, but I have to receive feedback from my students so I can keep giving them things. You know, like if then, if this, then that, if this, then that. If you can kind of, oh, if you can be the student in front of the class, if you can be the teacher as a student, if you can be a facilitator from both roles, then you're really creating this environment of experience that to me is the educator. And so the Yoga of Trust was an educator training that a lot of people are like, well, I want to learn from you. It was originally someone's like, oh, will you come to an Acro Yoga training like down in this area? Sure, but in good faith, I couldn't. If I just came and just taught people what I know, it'd be more of like a workshop, and that's fun. But I wanted to challenge myself, so I actually collaborated with one of my best friends in college who went in a completely different path than what he used to be a finance guy, and then things in life, and huge life changes for him. And he works in, you know, personal leadership and development, like both in like one-on-one and corporate environments. It's amazing. Hmm. And he's done a lot of work. We collaborated and we created this thing that, like, basically instead of teaching what and how to teach, we wanted to understand the who and the why of the teacher. And through that, be able to amplify whatever the what and how will be. And that it was a very profound experience on both experiences. And then, but there's a lot of people who show up thinking like, oh, I'm just going to get to like train. And that's the thing, like a teacher training. You just train a lot of the times. You don't get real opportunities or they don't tell you how to teach. They'll tell you, this is how we teach it. But you put more emphasis on like how we teach it. You forget, like, that means you're only learning what the teacher is teaching you how to teach. And if the teacher is a certain way, dare I say even not a really good teacher, but just someone who might be very experienced, you know, in a certain way, that you're only learning one perspective. Mm-hmm. And there's not just one body in this world. There's a whole host of rainbow assortment of people that, again, being able to trust in your abilities to move someone or move with someone as a teacher or as a someone who's leading them into a practice, whether it's solo or partner, you have to be very, very clear on what you're trying to say or speak or communicate, not just to one, but to everybody. And that's what these trainings are focused on. Is being able to be present for your own experience and know where your blind spots are and know where your strengths are and know where your challenges lie and how you can effectively understand all of that and then help other people identify theirs and then see how you can create a practice that works for everybody.
Mm-hmm. You travel the world teaching, leading these events, the Wanderlust, the festivals, the Yoga of Trust and things like that. Do you have a home base?
Yes. I have a home base. I had a home base that was in LA and it was good, but it wasn't. I didn't really like LA too much for many reasons. I just recently moved to the Bay Area. I've entered into a loving partnership with a wonderful woman and co-teacher, and we're creating things together. Nice. Our Bay Area base is where our horse is, which is beautiful. Honestly, I getting to this point in my life now, it's been a long time where I haven't had a place where I really felt super home or like even a desire. I've been homesick for something I don't even know. That this next year for me is really like making the effort to, even if I don't have a place to be at all the time, I want a place where it's my bed and it's my art on the walls. And it's, I know that the oven's been turned off, you know, and I know, oh yeah, there's a leak in the bathroom. Like I've done a lot of, expansion. And at this point, like, I think expanding from like a solid foundation will be my next big exciting journey.
Okay.
I would love it to be the Bay, but you know, everything has its pluses and it's not pluses. We're figuring it out.
Okay. Do you see your practice, personal practice, and your teaching offering? I'm assuming it sounds anyway like it's a continually evolving experience.
Mm-hmm.
What are you really excited about learning about right now?
Mm. Well, you know, I spent a whole long time really embodying the, you don't have to have one partner to do acro, or you don't have to have one specific, you don't have to practice every day to be a good yogi, right? Like, you know, my practice is very much like more based in the fact that I'm constantly moving around. So for me, I'm actually challenging myself. It's not even challenging. Like for me, the next real exciting area of focus is getting really good at working with one person, which is, you know, both professionally and personally in my own movement practice. But then also being a lot more, like where I get to really, I guess, focus on is how to maintain, I guess, clarity and focus on constantly feeling like having what I had said earlier, this idea of like a grounded home base, and not, and knowing that no matter where I am in the world, there's always somewhere to go back to. That does become one of the challenges of being a traveling, you know, yoga snake oil salesman, is that, it's very easy to be like, well, I'm going to be gone for 3 months. I might as well just go from here to here. And then I'll go, you know, take a break and go to here and go there. But really knowing that, like, after 10 years of just getting a chance to see this beautiful world, that, like, definitely wanting to enter in a place where, like, having a foundation and knowing that I can, like, really commit to that. It's not like I'm worried if I can or cannot. It's just more like I'm excited to have that spot and have a place. And then also, because then I get to have a quote-unquote home practice, which isn't just about yoga. It's like, what do I want to do every morning? I'm going to wake up and do this. I want to eat that. I want to go here. I want to see these people on a regular basis. And that there's a yoga to that, Brian.
Doesn't sound very exciting, though.
Sounds great. It sounds grass is greener, man. Grass greener, let me tell you. Grass is greener everywhere you look until you realize all you have to do is water your lawn. And then maybe, just maybe, you might have a really great lawn. So okay, just, you know, put your chair down, have your barbecue over there, little kiddie pool. It's hot, great. It's cold, fine. But it's your lawn. It's better than not having a lawn.
Yeah. Because your schedule is so varied and eclectic, it's probably hard to pin this down, but on average, how many hours would you say you're teaching per week?
Well, when I'm in season, a minimum of, we'll say 15 to 20. Because, like, the weekends, even though, we'll say it's a 15-hour weekend in class, but, like, they're full-on experiences. Like, you know, you add now, like, a couple hours between each, like, you're planning, you're doing this. Yeah, we'll just say a good 20 hours, 20, 25. If I'm on the road and I'm, like, teaching classes during the week to lead up to things, it could be as high as 30, almost 40 hours a week. You know, it does vary. And then there are times where I don't do crap for like a whole month, mm-hmm, and it feels real good. but then there's the whole other seedy underbelly of yoga teaching, which is admin.
That was the next question.
Yeah.
How much hours do you, not just admin, how many hours do you spend outside of the classroom that leads up? Could it be marketing? Could it be bookkeeping? Could be the emails back and forth?
Yeah, all of them. Oh, all of them. All of the hours. Well, and this is the other kind of strange thing. When you have people constantly kind of writing you, or constantly you're balancing, you know, okay, I'm planning this tour and I'm doing this, and you're, you know, 8 hour time difference, 12 hour time difference, 3 hour time difference. It's just, you know, as messages come in, there's times where you have to be like, I don't want, I'm done. And I'm still working on that. Like, if there's one thing I love to do is work, and there's another thing I love to do is really work. But then I also liked, it's nice to have, I guess the better question is, how many hours do I just give myself a day to not do work? I would like to say, like, if we say a typical work day would be from waking up around, you know, like, I wake up at, say, 6 or 7, and, like, I start to look at my phone by, like, 8 or 9. You know, I'm constantly trying to do blocks of work, like 2 or 3 hours at a time, take a break, go do something, anything, whether it's go play with the new horse or go practice or go climb a mountain or go for a bike ride or go make lunch or go visit a friend and then come back and do another couple hours of work. So I would say it's a full-time job. You know, weekends you're teaching, weekdays you're setting up the teaching. But you can do that from anywhere. So you get this idea of that, like, you get to kind of, it's like eating small meals throughout the day. Like, you can constantly stay full if you just kind of, you know, keep topping up the work. And at the same time, there are those times where you sit down and you just kind of do those long binges of just lots of work because you have to crush everything out. I don't have a great answer for you. It's basically 24 hours a day. But as a man who I think runs a yoga studio or has hands in a yoga studio, you get it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so I'm actually really curious for you, like, what did you do before all yoga happened?
What did I do?
Yeah.
Let's see. I worked in the corporate world for a little while, primarily in the restaurant business, mm-hmm. but also did some stints outside of it. Once I got into yoga, it was never entirely and completely yoga. Mm-hmm. I was doing home renovations for a while, and still like to make that a part of my life. Mm-hmm. I've written a novel. I do some t-shirt lines and some product sales as well. So it's varied and mixed. And that's what I love about the life.
Did you find that sort of, I guess there's like Brian after yoga and Brian before yoga, but did you find that, how did yoga kind of help you? Did the inclusion of yoga in your life from that point forward, or from whatever point you consider that like demarcation, has it created more joy or just more everything?
Well, my immersion, my introduction to yoga, came about from a life trauma. I had been injured. I was in the hospital for a month. Wow. And the yoga became my physical therapy.
Wow.
And so for a while it was purely physical. Mm-hmm. But as you know from the practice, it has this very insidious and
gets hooks in there.
Yeah, you don't even know what's happening, right. And suddenly you realize, damn it, I'm happy all
God,
the time.
God darn.
Yeah. Yeah. And I realize now if I avoid negative people, I'm less negative. Huh. I'm going to take that.
It's amazing.
So it was a very, you know, from before that point, there was absolutely no yoga in my life. And after that point, there absolutely was. Mm. But it was still a gradual process of recognizing I like the impact it has. And I need to make more of that happen. And how can I bring it outside of the classroom or off of the mat, as they say.
Right. Yeah. I feel like the best. I think of that, the yoga of standing in line, or the yoga of being in traffic, or the yoga of playing a video game, or being on the, like, you know, just like being, how do I bring what I've learned, quote unquote, on the mat or in the studio to other places? I feel like everything, like the studio stuff is, that's the decoration, actually. It's like, it's the external. Like, mm-hmm. you don't learn, I mean, you learn how it can like look/feel, but it's when you're able to drop into that same sort of idea that instead of avoiding the negative people, but how can you just stay grounded when negativity happens, mm-hmm. that you can, like, you know, that yoga can actually be there as a, not like a place to let off steam, but actually a place to keep you like firmly rooted in not having to let off steam later, you know? Yeah. I ask all this because, I mean, you know, the times that I've seen you kind of in a classroom setting, which has only been a few times, or even in like a community setting, that like I feel that you contribute it in a way that's not, it's not an aggressive, it's more of like a very suggesting or supportive way. Like, you know, like I think about yesterday when you're like, when you brought up a question, you know, when someone asks a question, it's a beautiful way of also contributing, like, what you're thinking, your experience, and then also asking other people, like, oh, well, I didn't think about that, you know? Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious, as now someone who teaches or is in more of a, like, this yoga lifestyle, were you always someone who questioned, or were you someone who just sort of listened and then thought and questions?
Well, I was, from a very, very early age, someone that I was never the center of attention, the life of the party, all the cliches that go along with that. I was more of the, go back to the cliches again, the wallflower, the one that held back the observer. Part of it was crippling social anxiety. I think whether that was the cause or just an aspect of it, I also spent a lot of time in books and I loved learning and I loved, you know, getting an education. And so when I'm in the group settings like the classroom, especially as an assistant, where I can step back and observe not just what is being taught, but how people are reacting to the teaching.
Right.
And being able to guide in subtle ways without being the one at the front waving the flag saying, everybody follow me.
Yeah,
you know,
totally.
You know, and so, yeah, that's what I enjoy, but it's also what I've recognized that I'm good at.
Yeah.
People don't always remember my name or who I am. But then over time, they go, oh, yeah, you were the one. Okay, now I remember you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny. What if I told you you could have that same impact on people while waving a flag, right? You know? And a lot
absolutely.
Of it just, and it simply just comes to if how, you know, like that's the beautiful part about being a teacher or being like that ringleader is just, it's when you say crippling social anxiety, like I had a lot of fear growing up about a lot of things. I swam competitively and I was actually quite a quiet wallflowerish child until about 12 or 13. And then I had a thing, which was great. And that's a whole nother story I don't want to get into, but, I noticed that the same fear that I had right before an event that I was like, literally like, oh my God, I'm getting so nervous. Like, I don't want to be here. Like that same feeling or that same feeling I had when I had to go speak in front of a group, you know, like teaching a, like doing a debate team or something like that. Or like when I was going to go meet someone, like I'm like, oh my God, I have to talk. I'm scared. Is that same fear that ended up, I reframed my relationship to it. And it became something that was like, oh, this is me just giving a shit about what's about to happen, mm-hmm. you know? And I can't speak to like it being crippling, but I can speak to being like, oh my God, I think I need to, where are the exits, right? But when I started to really relax into that idea that maybe this is just me super emphatically connecting to the energy of this moment, I was able to kind of redirect it. And I still feel that when I, before class settings, I felt that I'm like, oh my God, we're going to have a blog, you know, blog, like, podcast. Ugh. I mean, if there's one thing that I love to do is I like to be not polished. You know, I have no idea what's going to come out of my mouth half the time I open it. I don't even know how I'm going to finish the sentence. If it's going to be what punctuation, I will mess up words and I'll just say things like blah. And there's something beautiful about owning that. Not even imperfection, just owning being human that I think more people respond to than me being like the, like, you know, sun dappled, you know, striated muscle handstand this or that. It's like, I'm superhuman on a lot of levels, but like being able to embody yoga is not for people who are perfect. Yoga is for people who are imperfect, right? So if everyone who's perfect, if everyone who's teaching yoga looks perfect, how are the people who are in the back going, fuck you, dude. You don't even know what it's like to be in my body, right? Mm-hmm. And there's this idea of just speaking to the people who need it the most. Yeah. You know, we preach to the choir. These events, it's great. It's, everyone looks good, feels good. But it's like for the people who don't stand in the front of the class, the people who are in the back or like kind of like leery, I want to connect more with those people because I think that they'll do more with it. Like then, or maybe that's just me being like, meh, like the antisocial, like I'd rather just be in the back, you know, like not talking to everyone. I'd rather be in the back of the bus, like making fun of everyone than being up front. But there's this idea of like yoga's for everybody. And if we keep teaching just to one group, then not everyone hears it.
Well, and those people in the back that are resistant and reluctant, when they have the breakthrough, I mean, the joy,
right.
I mean, it's 10 times with the one that goes in and says, oh, I know I'll get a handstand eventually. It may not be today, but it's going to happen.
Yeah. And I feel like if I've had so many of those breakthroughs in my own practice where I'll be by myself or even with someone, I'll like look around and be like, oh my God, what just happened? This is amazing, you know? And I never take it for granted.
Yeah.
Never take it for granted that, especially when someone's a little leery, like I'm excited the most about that person because I really think that there's an opportunity I'm not trying to force a breakthrough, but like if I could be like, here's the experience you could have, and you know, I'll speak to these people who hear this, but you over there, you might like that, blah, and then just mm-hmm. like let it sit. Like that's where this becomes super fun.
Absolutely.
Because you get to really, that's the connection,
yeah.
as opposed to the showing.
Now we're going to go out and teach in a little bit. What are we teaching here?
Oh man, we have style and flow. The Acro Yoga Style and Flow, it's transitions, and we have the Art of Counterbalance.
Oh, very cool. Now, before we go up into that, I just want a couple quick, you know, just pop out a couple questions, you answer in a sentence or two, and these are really geared towards people that might want to get into the business of yoga or refine their business of yoga, mm-hmm. and this is based on your experience.
Sure.
So if you were to offer one or two quick tips of advice to people that want to get into travel teaching, what would you give them?
Don't expect to make money at first. Don't do it for the money. Do it for the community. Like, it's not about how much you make. It's not about how many people in the class. Like, if you want to travel teach, you have to build a name. Generally, people are leery about, like, especially in Europe,
you know, the people respond a lot more to quality as opposed to quantity. So yes, it's nice to have a good photo and a good this and a good that, but really focus on creating a great experience and people will gravitate to it. And a lot of it also, and that comes down to being authentic.
Okay.
Two, and this is something I'll say to a lot of people and they will be like, haha, whatever. And this is like my like backhanded jab is that if you always teach beginner workshops and you always teach beginners, you will always have students. You will always have students.
But I want to teach advanced stuff.
Well, you're a shitty teacher. I'm sorry. If you can only teach intermediate and advanced stuff, you're just not good because most of it's then, and then you do this. And then you do this. And you don't speak to anything else other than, and then you do this. And to be honest, if you hear this, whoever's out there and that bothers you, you know where to find me. I can help you be a better teacher.
Now, we talked a little a moment ago about the amount of work that we do, and everyone that I interview talks about, you know, the amazing amount of hours, the quantity of hours I put into our business, but we love it, so it's great. But life balance is also important.
Right.
How, any advice or suggestions for life balance?
Man, having a life, strange. Hobbies are very important. Doing things that aren't yoga or doing things that aren't, just doing different things is very important. Being awkward is great. Like, just taking up new skills and be like, man, I don't know how to cook. Well, I'm going to try to cook a dinner. Oh, I screwed up royally. Let's go out. That's fine. Like, always trying to constantly learn new things outside of what you do makes you realize why you do what you do. Because I'm really good at this. I'm going to stick with this. But then I'm also going to try to play tennis.
Mm-hmm.
Like, having a horse now, like, as a 36, 37-year-old guy who's never really spent any time around horses, like, I love him. I want to learn more about him. Like, this is a new thing for me. You know, having stuff that you can do anywhere or everywhere as just a release of, so you can just step back from what you normally do. And like, I love being outdoors. I love running. I love bike riding. I love, you know, being active. That doesn't mean I always am doing yoga outdoors or I'm doing yoga as active. Like, I'm like, I make a point to build up. To build up tightness so I can use my practice to loosen up. You know, like, I do things to support myself, you know, and I love cooking. So when I'm traveling, I can find different like meals that I want to bring back and try to play with. I always ask people about, like, you know, what recipes do you love to do? Or I love reading. I love street art. And a lot of times traveling and going to different cities, seeing people interact with their own environment and say, oh, this street sign's cool, but if I put a little thing on that, it's going to be even better.
Mm-hmm.
There's something very cathartic about just being swept up in something that's larger than you, that's not your focus.
Okay.
And because that's how yoga happened. I just was like, I was using yoga as the escape route. So when I went back to my day job, it was fine, but I realized, like, why don't I just take the escape route and then make that the day job? Now, what do I use as my escape route from yoga? Everything else. And it's great.
Yeah. All right. Two more questions.
Great.
Any advice for giving back?
As far as just to the community, to the world at large?
In any way. For some people, they have a charity that they're really passionate about. For some people, it's actually a yoga experience they give to maybe people that wouldn't come to it otherwise. Anything
right.
at all.
Okay, so like, a lot of times, you know, people, I wish I could come to your class, but I can't. Well, you should come. You know, I'm not a fan of like giving out things for free. When it comes to my work, but it's not like I don't want people to show up. I simply ask, okay, you can't afford money. What can you afford? Tell me a story. What's your favorite meal? Make two. You know, mm-hmm. Where should, like, show me something that's amazing. Like, just, I, like, that scholarship of, like, well, I'm putting effort and energy in doing, and, like, yeah, I can just easily bring you on, but then that devalues to me. It almost is like, it devalues the, But like, just kind of devalues, like, well, yeah, sure, I don't mind. Anyone can come and watch this. There's something about that. Maybe that's good. Some people won't like that, but there's something about, it's like, it's not like, what do you have? What am I going to get from you? It's like, really, what are you willing to offer? Even if it's just like, you know what? I really don't, like, I can't, but I'd love to be there. Like, I just asking, if you're asking and you're expecting me to say yes, then you should also maybe expect me to say no. But instead of saying no, I should be like, well, what else can we do? I like the conversation.
So some sort of energy exchange.
Anything. anything, just so it's like, hey, I would love to do this, and like, if I could do a little body work on you, great. Maybe I won't even take the body work. But it's just like, it's something that's like, it's like, I'd love to be there, and I can offer this in exchange. Oh man, you've made, it's an invitation. Well, I accept. You know, it becomes an energetic exchange or something, as opposed to just tacking another body into a room.
Okay.
For me. But giving back to a larger group, you know, I gotta say, I think, whereas one thing that's grown incredibly in my life from in the past 10 years is the idea of gratitude, charity has not always been my main focus. And that's only because there's so much going on, like, right in front, that maybe there can be a bit more focus on that. And I wish I had a better, like, oh, I love to support this and I support that. But honestly, when I see, like, usually it's just very, like, point, case-by-case basis. If someone's like, oh, you know, I need to raise money for this or this, like, it's when I hear a cause that I believe in, I support it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not because I don't support any one thing. I just want to support anything that really, again, asks or has this idea of, like, of creating, like, you know, of an invitation. Like, oh, like, this is kind of like, you know, this, if I hear, like, oh, man, this, you know, someone, I need to raise money for this type of research. Amazing. It hits me at the right time. There's some money. You know, like, oh, can I volunteer at this event? Can I be here? Can I do that? Sure. But I guess I can't say that there's one particular charity that I would support, because it's really just...
Whatever hits you in the
moment. Whatever gets me when I'm receptive, it gets me.
All right, last question. Are you an introvert or an extrovert?
Oh, God. So I thought I was an extrovert for so long. It turns out, Brian, I am a very extroverted introvert. And
really?
That was where I realized that extroverts are great at giving, and they don't even really need to refill. Like, the giving is the refill, I think. It turns out that, like, is when I've given all I can give, the drop-off is huge, and then I just fall into the cave of, like, an introverted, you know, like my quills come out and I just become super dangerous. And that doesn't mean I might be very extroverted up to a point, but the baseline, I think, is I just need time for myself. Whether if it's a small, it could be a small amount of time, and I might have a huge resource, like, to draw from, but when it's done, it's done.
I almost didn't ask the question because I thought, oh, it's so obvious with him. He's totally an extrovert. So I'm glad I asked.
No, I'm real good at, like, pretending extrovert. But I didn't, and it's something I didn't really think too much about until the past year or so, but I really, cause also this idea of empathy or being an empath of being super hypersensitive.
Mm-hmm.
I would often extrovert myself as the armor to kind of block out all of the things that I'm experiencing. So it's that I can just be louder. I can be more visual, you know, all these kind of things. Then, like, I don't actually have to take in the barrage of energy that I'm constantly getting at all times. Maybe that could be undiagnosed ADD. Maybe that could be a lot of different things, which is totally possible. But being able to sort of soften up and then lean more into that introverted foundation, and then realize, oh, I've got 36 years of actually being extroverted too, feels really good to have many times struck a balance that allows me to be outward when I need to, but then also listen to when I need to go in and not push past that.
Okay. So, Daniel, people want to get in touch with you. How can they do that?
ds@danielscottyoga.com, facebook.com/danielscottyoga, instagram@danielscottyoga. Basically, just put Daniel Scott Yoga into any sort of search bar and I'll probably come up. It's a good place to start. Strike up a conversation, send an email, send a picture, tell me your favorite, was it recipe or bad joke? I will respond.
All right. Daniel, thank you so much.
Brian, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed the conversation. If you would like to learn more about Daniel Scott, find out where he's teaching, you can go to his website, his Facebook page, YouTube, Instagram, and all the different social media by looking up Daniel Scott Yoga. You can find links to Daniel Scott's social media in the show notes on the website yogamat.chat. A special thank you to Davide DiCenzo for introducing the episode. Now, he teaches yoga, hand balancing, and acro yoga. You can find a link to Davide's website in the show notes at yogamat.chat. A big thank you to 13 Hands for allowing us to use the song Big Love in the musical opening and closing of this episode. Now, if you haven't heard, there's a really big event that's coming up on Veterans Day, which is November 11th this year. It's happening all over the country, and teachers will be running a special class that is dedicated to the veterans of the U.S. military to honor their efforts and to bring awareness to the 22 veterans who commit suicide every day. All proceeds from the class will go to a scholarship fund that will send veterans and family of veterans to a yoga teacher training run by Vetoga. Vetoga was created by veterans for veterans. You can learn more on the Facebook page for Boundless Service. You can also sign up to be a participant or a teacher on Boundless Service's website, or you can look up the hashtag HelpingVetsHelpVets. If you enjoyed this episode of Chats from the Mat, you can really help us out by sharing the episode or by reviewing the episode wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also follow us on our social media by searching for Chats from the Mat. Thank you, and we hope to have you around for the next interview.
Listen up, gather around. Tell your friends I'm coming to town. I'm selling love, I'm peddling compassion. Just basic decent human interaction. It's not an occasion.